Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, November 13th, 2017. The troops and tanks are gone along Airport Road, but General Palma Long remains in house arrest.
I'm relieved because tanks are no longer there. I can move to airport freely, but in a few days you cannot move there because you use only one road that can connect you there.
And newly certified pastors in South Sudan say peace begins at home.
The Bible says that the gospel of Jesus Christ is also referred to as the gospel of peace. Until there is peace in the heart of people because of knowing Jesus, there can never be good peace in any country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. On Saturday, the Kiir administration withdrew dozens of soldiers and several tanks it had deployed around the house of former Army Chief of Staff General Palma Long for the past week in Juba. A military spokesman says the government withdrew its troops after Malong agreed to release dozens of his bodyguards. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Juba.
For the past week, many Juba residents said seeing soldiers deployed along the main road leading to General Malong's residence in Juba International Airport frightened them. Juba resident Dut Solomon says he's glad the tanks are gone.
I'm relieved because tanks are no longer there. I can move to airport freely, but in a few days you cannot move there because you use only one road that can connect you there.
Resident Abor Mabian Nial says it was dangerous for tanks to be deployed in the middle of the city where civilians pass all the time.
Tanks should not be put in the city because when anything happens, it can destroy the whole city, which is not good. Our people's life is more precious than anything. We are happy they have been removed.
South Sudan Army spokesman Brigadier General Lulroy Kwang says the dispute over Malong's refusal to relinquish a platoon of 30 soldiers, which he kept inside his residence since May when he was first held under house arrest, has been resolved peacefully.
The issue of saying, yes, it is good to solve it amicably, took center stage. And we are glad once again to inform the people of South Sudan that the misunderstanding, which was exaggerated by the social media, had been peacefully and amicably resolved. And the Chief of General Staff is free to travel as soon as he meets the Commander-in-Chief of SPLA and the President of the Republic.
Kong did not say when that would happen, but indicated it would be soon. Kong says the tanks and soldiers deployed around Malong's residence were removed on Saturday because Malong accepted the Kiir administration's demand that he release his bodyguards.
The withdrawal was reached after the former Chief of General Staff agreed and accepted to comply with the presidential order that instructed him to reduce the number of his bodyguards from 30 to 4 armed guards.
Earlier today, General Malong began sending away some of his guards who surrendered their weapons, according to Kong.
Just some few minutes ago, I received a confirmation that he had already handed over 18 of his bodyguards. And there were some of the light and heavier weaponry he had, one including 12.7 machine guns, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and light machine guns like PKM.
Kong acknowledges that deploying tanks and dozens of soldiers around Malong's house scared many civilians.
When the roadblocks were set up, increased forces were deployed and they were everywhere. Some public road users were inconvenienced in so many ways, and therefore it was said that it was high time for these soldiers to be withdrawn.
Kong assured the public that there will be no more troops or tanks deployed to General Malong's residence.
In the same week, security organs heard a security review, and it was realized that there was no direct threat on the government and to the people of South Sudan in general, and residents of Juba in particular.
General Malong is still at his residence, but Kong says he will soon be allowed to travel outside the country for medical treatment. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
More than 200 South Sudanese received graduate degrees today from a U.S.-based nation-to-nation Christian university in Juba. The university's president says South Sudan needs religious leaders more than anything else right now to achieve sustainable peace and urged the new pastors to fight division and hatred. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Marching on the street of Juba in black and red-colored gowns and caps, young men and women vowed to follow Jesus and carry out his mission in South Sudan. For the past 3 years, the 212 graduates studied the Bible and various courses offered by a U.S.-based nation-to-nation Christian university. The ululation and celebratory atmosphere for these newly graduated pastors is not just about receiving certificates, but about a unified hope for peace in a country where deadly conflict has dragged on for nearly 4 years. Dr. Brick Clift is president of the Nation to Nation Christian University.
The Bible says that the gospel of Jesus Christ is also referred to as the gospel of peace. Until there is peace in the heart of people because of knowing Jesus, there can never be good peace in any country.
The conflict broke out in December 2013 when soldiers loyal to President Salva Kiir fought troops loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. The peace deal the two signed in August 2015 did not end the conflict, and in the ensuing years, fighting has spread to previously peaceful parts of the country. Cliff says he knows what South Sudanese must do to restore peace.
We know that it begins with the heart of people. It begins with them putting their faith in Jesus Christ and receiving a new nature, receiving the love of God for others.
Marcelo Bona Luis, the pastor in charge of the Juba Christian Center, says with this graduation comes the hope of sustainable peace in South Sudan.
When we are graduating men and women of God that will go out to preach the gospel, then our nation is changed. They will bring transformation.
Bishop Ezekiel Dinga Jang of Teach East Diocese says that transformation will only come if the new graduates fight tribal division first.
As you're going out now, you are going to have a good fight. Fight the good fight of division among the people. In Christ, there is no Nuer, there is no Dinka, there is no Anyuak, there is no Mrule, there is nobody. We are one in the Lord.
A student representative, Dr. Makwala Kech, says that is possible because what they learned will first be demonstrated in their personal lives.
We can study so that we know, and when we have known, it has to be applied in our daily life. So when we desire to change, first, we need to be changed in order to be agents of change, because our lifestyle speaks better than our word. And this is the problem in this nation. We speak, we talk, but we do little.
McCall, who holds a doctorate in education, says he decided to do a study for a bachelor's degree in theology in order to get that internal change. McCall vows to work with the new pastors to bring about a real change, which he says South Sudan desperately needs. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The Anglican Bishop of the Wau Diocese says President Kiir and his military generals are responsible for the suffering in South Sudan. Right Reverend Moses Deng Bol says he continues to remind South Sudan's leaders their actions are the cause of the pain and suffering across the country. Bishop Deng tells John Tanza at a youth meeting in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, that he will not be afraid to speak out about the South Sudan crisis, despite receiving a death threat this year.
The problem of South Sudan is not the people, not the land, not the insect, not the animals, not the trees. And the problem of South Sudan is not the international community. The problem of South Sudan, I have said, is the president and the generals, because they have refused to abide by the rule of law. Instead, they are promoting the rule of gun, which has resulted in massive loss of lives and properties of innocent civilians. Number two, the problem is the president and the generals, because they have refused to hold people who have committed atrocities accountable. Instead, they are being treated as heroes and heroes. Number five, the problem is the president and the generals, because they have denied South Sudanese their basic democratic principle and freedom of speech and expression. FM radios are being shut down, and their reporters being threatened by the infamous unknown gunmen. And similarly, civil society organizations and individuals, including church leaders, who dare to correct the government where it has gone wrong, are being categorized as politicians or rebel supporters. And then I have said, number six, it is the president and the generals who are the problem of this country, because they have refused to hold people who have stolen hundreds of millions of public funds accountable. And then number seven, which is the last one, is the president and the generals who are the problem, because I was advising the president not to associate himself with a self-appointed tribal group, especially the so-called Jiang Council of Elders. Because associating himself with this group is damaging the unity of South Sudanese and future of the Jiang community. Why a colonel in MI called me and said...
That's the military intelligence.
The military intelligence, yes. And she said, he said, Dinka kachingida lakuma, which means there is nothing difficult for the government to do. And the interpretation from my family and also friends is that that is a threat to mean that unknown gunmen can come to my place anytime. Now, the thing is, I believe...
And how did you feel after hearing that threat? How did you feel?
Well, as a human being, I felt a concern about that, but I think I have made a decision, and I will continue to say the truth. And I believe that if God say you cannot die, even if death was next to you, you are not going to die. Others.
Yes, and you told me that your brother who followed you did not take the threat lightly. What did he do?
Well, he called the guy and he told him that, my brother, I want you to withdraw your threat. Because if you continue with those threats, I want to advise you that it is not only... Because he said he's working in the office of the president. He said it's not only those who are working in the office of the president who can fight. Others who are not working in the office of the president can also fight. So I want you to withdraw the threat. And the gentleman said, no, I was not making a threat. But the fact that he said there is nothing difficult to the government, make it a threat, of course. But he denied, and my brother said, okay, if you have denied it, fine, it's okay.
And how is the situation in Wau? We hear a lot about people who have left their homes and they're living in UN camp. How do you live in Wau when you're the people that come to your church every Sunday are living in a camp?
Well, you see, the situation was very worse in 2015, 2016, 2017, even earlier this year. But now... There are two factors that have contributed to at least the calm is coming down a bit. Not so much, but it is really different from where it was in 2016, 2017, earlier. For example, in my house in January this year, it was actually covered by over 5,000 people. I think you may have heard of that.
Yeah, we did a story on that.
Yes, that was my compound, actually.
The mayor and the national security came and told
him. Yes, and then they removed them. They were taken to a place called Musena.
That is Bishop Moses Dengbol, the bishop of the Anglican Church in Wau State, speaking to John Tanza in Kigali, Rwanda. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. South Sudanese youth gather in Kigali to talk about their country's future. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how old is your oldest relative? What is their health secret?
One of my oldest relative is 112 years, and the secret of that, because he's eating the national food. He don't drink, he don't smoke, and he exercise a sport.
My oldest relative is my grandma. She's almost like 70-something, and her health secret is she keep it traditional with the food, especially. Like, she always gets the traditional food, and that's what she liked, like the asida and the greens.
That will be, I think, 95. And their secret was the diet. They ate a lot of vegetables and less of meat.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Around 70 young South Sudanese men and women are meeting in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, to talk about the political crisis in their country. Peter Biar Ajak, head of South Sudanese Young Leaders Forum, which organized the meeting, tells my colleague John Tanza, South Sudan's leaders have failed to end the conflict, which has affected most people in the country. So the nation's young people are figuring out how to do things differently.
South Sudan Young Leaders Forum is a platform through which young leaders of South Sudan, both within the country and outside the country, both within the areas controlled by the government and areas controlled by the opposition, including also refugee camps, is a forum that all these young leaders use to centralize their efforts so that they push for peace and development in their country.
What do you intend to achieve by bringing the youth from all these different groups? What is the intention?
The intention is to see, do we really feel the same? Because everyone who is in South Sudan, whether you are in Rumbek, in Awil, in Yambio, Torit, or Bor, people are suffering each day, and people wonder, is this exactly the way the others are feeling? Because if others feel the same, then how do we allow ourselves to live in such a condition? So we come here to see, as young leaders of South Sudan, who are playing various roles, who are at the forefront of change and development, who come from academia, religious society, from political parties, from all the different organs of society, including the military, we come to see, do we feel the same? And this is the discussion we are having.
Some people are not happy with what you are doing. Why do you think you have a lot of enemies out there?
Well, it is obvious that people will be quite unhappy with what I'm doing because they're thinking that this is something that I'm doing alone. They think this is a Peter Biar Ajak who's doing it. They don't realize that these are young people of South Sudan across all different groups that are coming together and they're developing their own ideas. They want to save their country. They want to think about the future of their children. And what has allowed the political leaders of South Sudan to consistently destroy the country, use the people, pillage the resources, is the ability to divide the people of South Sudan along regional, ethnic, and tribal lines. And through that, they have been able to hold on to political power, which they use to loot and funnel resources to their own networks. So this is a threat to them.
I hate to ask personal questions, Peter. There is a lot going out there. Like yesterday, I was reading something and I was a little bit shocked. You were being called names, being accused of embezzling funds. What is your reaction to these allegations?
I think most people who know me will be shocked to hear those allegations. But you see, the environment that has been created by South Sudan, especially the breakdown of rule of law, is it has allowed an environment in which insults and accusations are hurled around without any consequences. Secondly, I come from among the elites of South Sudan. My father is a general in the military. My father-in-law was the chief of staff. And people automatically think that I would behave the same way in which many among my peers, among the elites, have behaved in how the state has been looted. So people would think naturally, given that I have access to this network, that I would use it to funnel resources to my own networks.
South Sudanese will be wondering, why did you decide to bring 70-plus youth to Kigali, Rwanda? Why not in Juba? Such meetings should be in Juba.
Well, we do these meetings in Juba. In fact, from the 1st to the 2nd of November, we did a two-day meeting in Juba in which we invited all the different elements within the government. We invited the SPLM in government, the one headed by Salva Kiir. We invited the SPLM in opposition, the one headed by Thaban Deng. We invited the SPLM FDs. They all came. The Secretary Generals came. We invited the National Dialogue. We invited IGAD, but IGAD did not come. And these messages that we are being discussing in Kigali, this message I'm sharing with you, is not something that is coming from me. This forum started in January, and it started in January because the people of South Sudan were feeling that their leaders were not feeling their pain. Because if indeed they were feeling their pains, they would have found ways to end war. But because they were not feeling their pains, they were very reluctant and unwilling to make necessary compromises needed for leaders to save the lives of their people. So the young leaders feel that they can no longer stand on the sidelines and allow themselves to be divided along ethnic, tribal, political, or whatever that our politicians have used to divide our people. And they say to themselves that they are stepping up to provide the kind of leadership that South Sudan need, because indeed, South Sudan need new kind of leadership.
That's Peter Biar Ajak, coordinator of the South Sudanese Young Leader Forum, speaking to John Tanza in Kigali. Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says it has completed its investigation into 13 deaths linked to the country's election protest. It says some of the cases may end up going to trial, including the deaths of a 9-year-old girl and a 6-month-old girl. The authority says the little girl was killed by a bullet while she was on her family's balcony. The baby was killed when she was hit by a police baton when officers raided her parents' home looking for protesters. The police have said human rights groups' allegations of more than 30 deaths are false. The Police Oversight Committee also has investigated complaints of police brutality against university students at a demonstration. It has urged strict disciplinary action be taken against some of the officers involved. Human rights groups say as many as 66 people died in violence ahead of the presidential election in August and in the weeks before the court ordered a rerun last month. UNESCO's Global Education Monitoring Report shows some of the challenges sub-Saharan countries like South Sudan face in providing quality education for all children, one of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. UNESCO figures show that Africa lags behind other parts of the world in educating young people. For example, 41% of children do not finish primary school, and 87% of those enrolled do not reach the minimum proficiency level in reading. The latest report looks at some of the reasons for the failures, including school management, corruption, and the quality of teachers. Manos Atonis is the director of the report and spoke with VOA's William Eagle about the problems with Africa's schools.
The main reason is, first of all, that the education systems in sub-Saharan Africa expanded rapidly after 2000, with the result that it was very difficult for national education systems and teacher education systems to catch up. But in addition to that, there were also financial constraints, not just capacity constraints. And governments tried to make up for that by increasingly, in some cases, hiring contract teachers. And these contract teachers had not received the expected officially mandated training, but only very short-term training.
Are not contract teachers trained on the same level as conventional teachers?
The big problem in many sub-Saharan African countries was precisely that there was a rapid need for the supply of teachers to expand. And the decision was taken that there was no time to wait for teachers to go through 2 or 3 years of education before they could be hired. Another idea was that attracting trained teachers to rural areas might have been very complicated. Perhaps attracting teachers who were prepared to be paid less would have fewer qualifications, but would be actually coming from some of the more remote areas, would be a more promising strategy to fill the teacher gap quickly.
Many people cite the failure of teachers to show up at school, but the Global Education Monitoring Report says that issue is actually more complicated than that. I wonder if you could touch on that issue. I think that, for example, some governments are said not to officially allocate all of the school days available, or that there are other reasons for teacher absence beyond the teacher's control.
Indeed, the report urges caution because often many other reasons that are related to the system are really responsible for the fact that absenteeism levels seem to be high. or there are issues related to training. Teachers are often sent to training that the system is not prepared to accommodate for.
Manas, to what degree does corruption affect the quality of teaching in Africa? For example, we hear about so-called ghost roles or the failure of the state to deliver promised resources.
The absenteeism of teachers who are considered ghost teachers. We quote an example from Nigeria where 8,000 teachers in 4 states were reported collecting their official salary. And sometimes it's even difficult to understand how many teachers are ghosts because they may be appointed not to schools but to local governments and still receiving salaries without teaching. We also have other more subtle phenomena of corruption. When teachers are being paid very poorly, there is in some countries a phenomenon of private supplementary tuition where teachers may not be teaching the full curriculum in the class, but may be inviting students, those who can afford, to join them after school in additional classes where they deliver the full curriculum. So teachers then receive additional tuition fees from students in order to be taught the full curriculum and get trained in order, for example, to pass an exam.
The report says that public and civic activism has forced many governments to improve education. Can you give examples of where citizen activism has made a difference?
All countries, in some way or another, have ratified some international treaty that calls upon them to respect and fulfill the rights to education. But in only 55% of countries, can citizens legally challenge and take the government to court when they violate the rights to education? And in fact, only in 41% of countries have citizens exercise this possibility, and that has often led to very effective interventions and changes on the government side. The legal route is not the only solution. Civil society has other routes. You expect, for example, the parliament to be able to challenge government, like an education committee, for example, of a parliament, to be able to ask the right questions when the budget is submitted. So civil society has, in some cases, played the role of helping provide capacity to parliamentarians to build their skills in order to ask the questions and send back the budget to the government. That's an example which has happened in Tanzania. Another example is when actually citizens take the case to the streets. In South Africa, there has been an example of a well-publicized case of university tertiary education fees that were very high and increasing at rapid rates that were excluding the poorer students. The fees must fall movement was then generated and was fueled with effective use of social media, which helped organize students, took them to the street, and as a result, the government was obliged to freeze fees and to institute a commission that is expected to deliver its verdict on what should be the future funding policy and fee-paying policy in the country to enable tertiary education to be affordable.
That's Manos Antonis, the director of UNESCO's Global Monitoring Report. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Poison by Daddy Lumba. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for being here. We want to hear your comments about this show. Drop us a line on the web at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can find us on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
Oh, 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 oh